We continue now with our chat with Rupert Sheldrake. Dr. Sheldrake studied natural sciences at Cambridge and philosophy at Harvard. He holds a PhD in biochemistry from Cambridge and was a fellow at Clare College, Cambridge. He's the author of several books and more than 50 technical papers, and his new work is Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home and Other Unexplained Powers of Animals. Now, your scientific experiments with animals were predated by a few folks, included among them a Russian neurophysiologist named Vladimir Bekhterev. Can you tell us a bit about his work?
Bekhterev was working in Russia earlier this century, and he came across a circus dog that, as a circus performer, had this dog that he could give mental commands to, and the dog would obey these commands. And Bekhterev decided to investigate this. I mean, he was an admirably open-minded fellow, and he asked the circus dog trainer to come to his laboratory and his apartment with the dog. And he found he could get this chap to give commands to the dog completely silently, even when the dog couldn't see him, and the dog would go and do what he asked him to do, like running across the room, jumping up onto a table, picking up a particular book in his mouth, coming down and putting it in a particular place. He asked him how he did it, and the dog trainer, who was called Durov, told him that he just formed a clear picture in his mind of what the dog was going to do from the dog's point of view, and then gave it a kind of mental push, and the dog would do it. Bekhterev found he could do the same thing with the dog, and he trained a dog of his own to do this kind of thing. And in his experiments, he was convinced that this was not just a matter of subtle clues, body language, and so on, or eye movements, because he had screens and removed all those clues from the dog. So he experimentally demonstrated what, in fact, is common knowledge among dog trainers. The formidable British dog trainer Barbara Woodhouse, who wrote a lot of books on dog training, had no doubt about this. She said that when you give a command to a dog, it's not just a matter of the way you say it or the way your body is, but you have to think it too and send a clear mental picture to the dog of what you want it to do, and then it will do it. And this, for her, what for Bekhterev was a weird phenomenon that he investigated and found really was telepathic. For Barbara Woodhouse, she took this completely for granted, and all the people who followed her method of dog training just take it for granted.
It's very interesting that you say that, because if you get the mental picture in your head about some behavior that you want stopped, the dog is reading the mental picture of your head, like whether it's eating garbage and other things from the street. If you have that picture of how disgusting that is, that reinforces it.
Yes, well, I think it's very important to pay attention to the mental pictures you have with animals. And not all pet owners know this, but I think many experienced animal trainers are well aware of it. And people who are very, very successful with animals, I think, do this as a matter of course.
Now, dogs aren't the only animals with telepathic skills. You talk in the book about cats that answer the phone and even give some examples of humans that have been known to anticipate members of the tribe. Aboriginal people have less cultural conditioning, so we can understand that. But even in places like Norway, they have a name for the phenomenon of telepathy.
In Norway, in rural Norway, there's a phenomenon called the Vardaga, which means warning soul, and it's a phenomenon whereby people know who's going to come and visit the house. They know when someone's about to come to the house, up to half an hour in advance. It's very like dogs knowing when their owners are coming home. I think that these telepathic skills are much better developed in animals than they are in most people. But in people, in traditional societies, they're much better developed than they are in our modern world, where I think they've been greatly suppressed. One of the places where I think they occur quite commonly in the modern world, and this is something I'm investigating at the moment, is between mothers and babies. I think there's a very close bond between mothers and babies, particularly nursing mothers and babies. This is very close, and it's very biological, and it serves an obvious biological function. If the mother is away from the baby and she knows when the baby needs her, so she can go back to feed the baby, or if she just feels she's needed and goes back to it, this is obviously of survival value for the mother-baby pair. So this is one of the things I'm investigating at the moment, and if any women have had these kinds of experiences with babies, I'd love to hear from them, because I'm collecting data on this at the moment.
Dr. Mona Lisa Schultz was on the program describing about how she was jogging in Portland and her mother on the other coast, on the other side of the continent, knew immediately that something had happened to her. So perhaps that's one suggestion for the new book or for the research. The notion of how dogs and other animals are capable of homing in on people with whom they have a strong connection is linked to a theory of yours expressed in previous books, the notion of morphic fields. Now, as I understand from reading the book, this comes out of your experience with biology and is based on a theory that goes back to the 20s, the notion of morphogenetic fields. So perhaps you can give us a primer on morphic and morphogenetic fields.
In the 1920s, a number of biologists became convinced that embryology, the growth of embryos, the development of plants from seeds, could not be explained just in terms of genetic material and proteins. They didn't know about DNA then, but their argument was actually one that's valid even today. They pointed out that all the cells of the body have the same chromosomes. We now would say they all have the same genes. That the different cells develop in a different way. And if you think of the arm and the leg, for example, they've got the same genes in all the cells. They've got the same proteins. There's no chemical difference between an arm and a leg. And yet they have different shapes. Now, what is it that gives the shapes? It can't be just the genes, because otherwise all the cells would be programmed identically. It's not just the chemicals, because otherwise the arm and the leg wouldn't have different shapes. There's something else, a bit like a plan. If you think about buildings, the form of a building isn't determined by the building materials. With the same bricks and timber and things, you can build houses of different shapes with different architects' plans. And they thought there was something that gave a plan to the organism, which they called the morphogenetic field, the form-shaping field. That idea is now very common in developmental biology. There is a need for an organizing field to explain how organisms develop. I think that these organizing fields are in fact a new kind of field in nature. I've taken that idea and developed it further. And morphogenetic fields are just one kind of organizing field, the ones for developing organisms. Behavioral fields organize the behavior of organisms through coordinating the activity of brains. Social fields organize the activity of social groups and coordinate the different members of the group. So members of a flock of birds or a school of fish can turn almost simultaneously without bumping into each other. And I think that these morphic fields underlie the social bonds that exist between members of a pack of wolves or members of a human family or mothers and babies. And I think that the bonds between dogs and people or cats and people are morphic fields. That's the nature of the bond. When a person goes away from the animal, say someone goes away from home to work or on holiday, that bond is not broken, it stretches. There's a non-local connection that remains in place between the person and the animal, and that's what serves as a channel for telepathy. It's only because of the bond that the channel is there. That's why telepathy normally occurs only between people and animals, or animals and animals, or people and people that have close emotional bonds with each other.
To get a better sense of how these work, you liken morphic fields to magnetic fields, and how when you have a magnet and, say, iron filings and you move it, they all respond in that way. It's very similar to the school of fish that you just alluded to.
That's right. The magnetic field is the most familiar field to all of us. I mean, anyone who's played with magnets as a child or as a grown-up will have a direct sense of this. The field is invisible. You can't see it. But you can see its effects on iron filings. You can render the effects of the field visible through the lines of force that the iron filings take up. But if you take away the iron filings, the field's still there, even though there's no way of detecting it except through magnetic phenomena or electrical phenomena. I think that morphic fields are like that. They're within and around the organisms or the societies that they organize. They're invisible, but they have visible effects. And just as moving a magnet can change the pattern of iron filings, I think that the moving morphic field of the whole flock, it's like a group mind, if you like, is what coordinates the individuals within it. They're not just looking at their neighbors to see what they do.
We're talking with renowned scientist Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. He is the author of Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home and Other Unexplained Powers of Animals. I'm Paul Nelson. Let's follow that school of fish notion and the group mind in fish, because it's fascinating when we think of what you call the fountain effect in fish, or what is called the fountain effect in fish, and also the flash expansion. Just a delightful mental picture that I get from reading the book.
Yes, there are many forms of behavior that fish show. For example, if a predator attack moves towards a school of fish, the fish will undergo a flash expansion around the predator. They all move away from the predator and create a sort of hole in the school around the predator. And they accelerate extremely rapidly in this flash expansion, yet they don't bump into each other.
How fast do they go?
Well, in terms of miles per hour, I'm afraid I can't remember exactly how fast they go, but it's an extremely rapid expansion. They accelerate through several body lengths in a fraction of a second. And you can model. It's one of the more interesting kinds of computer model of animal behavior involves models of flocks of birds or schools of fish. There's a model called Boyd's by Craig Reynolds, which many people have seen on computers. These models are interesting in a way, but they're based on just looking at what happens between immediate neighbors. Or the more sophisticated recent models that are on computers now take into account, as it were, the field of the group. So it's interesting that the limitations of these earlier computer models are being overcome by coming closer and closer to a field model of flock or school behavior. And so, in a sense, there's a parallel development of this idea through the computer modeling of these flocks and schools.
Mm-hmm. Similar to the superorganism theory as ascribed to social insects, ant colonies and that kind of thing, which is something we could get into, but I'm seeing how we're running out of time and there's so many questions that I have. I mean, we could have you here for hours. One thing I definitely want to talk about is China and how that bias against learning something from animals does not exist as it does in Western science. In fact, China, according to the book, has gone further than most countries by committing resources to the scientific study and implementation of animals as earthquake predictors.
They have, yes. The Chinese have taken this seriously. It's been known for centuries all around the world that animals often behave in an unusual way before earthquakes. Cats hide, dogs become restless and seemingly afraid. Horses behave abnormally, wild birds, caged birds. Many of them behave in an unusual way. This has been observed since classical times in all parts of the world. In recent years, in the California earthquakes of 89, the Loma Prieta quake and the 94 Northridge quake, there were many signs of animal behavior, as I've discovered with the help of my research assistant in California, David J. Brown. And in the recent earthquakes in Greece and Turkey, I found there were many examples of unusual animal behavior. So there were in Assisi in the 1997 quake in Italy. In the West, this animal behavior is completely ignored. Seismologists treat earthquakes as a physics problem or as a geology problem, and they regard stories about animal behavior as just anecdotal. That's what they say. They just dismiss them all. Well, the Chinese, luckily, have not done that, and they ask people to report when they see unusual animal behavior. And when they get a surge of unusual animal behavior, this makes them look very carefully at other signs, and it's enabled them to give quite a number of very successful earthquake warnings. They've evacuated whole cities, hundreds of thousands of people, hours before huge earthquakes devastated those cities. They did this first in the 70s, but they've been doing it ever since. In the West, the official earthquake researchers have now pronounced it's impossible to forecast earthquakes, which lets them off the hook of ever getting predictions wrong. They don't make them at all. They still continue to use large amounts of public money to fund their research, but they've given up predicting earthquakes. I think, however, looking again at animal signs could lead to an effective earthquake prediction system. And with the help of telephones and the internet, there could be millions of people, particularly on the west coast of the US, who could be trained to look for these signs and to call in to a free number if they saw these signs. And then if there was a surge of calls from a particular region, this could well help in predicting earthquakes.
Yet, though, we're up against that bias against animals in research, unless we're dissecting them, something which you believe is anti-scientific. We talked about that before.
Yes, I think there's a bias on the part of science professionals against this. But say some independent body set up an earthquake pet line where you could call in. If this wouldn't require very much funding. If the official seismological people didn't want to be part of it, they needn't be. But if it was possible on the basis of pets to produce a few successful predictions, I don't think in the early stages it would be right to issue warnings on the basis of pets, because false alarms can be very counterproductive. But if there was enough data to show this is for real, then I think the state government, the federal government, and the general public and insurance companies would all say to the official earthquakers, look, you guys, why don't you get together with these people and work out, integrate both of them? And I think that would be the way forward, not to have one or the other, but both together.
Chances are in this society it'd be motivated by the insurance companies, but that's a whole other story. Dean Radin has done some experiments at the University of Nevada on that two-legged animal that suggests some interesting notions about time. Showing people images on a computer screen.
Yes, Dean Radin is, I think, one of the most inventive of modern parapsychologists. And he's done some brilliant experiments on what he calls presentiment, knowing in advance when things are happening, or feeling in advance when things are happening. In his experiments, people sit in front of a blank computer screen, and then after 30 seconds or so of the screen blank, a picture flashes up on the screen, and while this happens, people's skin resistance and their heartbeat are monitored. The skin resistance, as in a lie detector test, gives a measure of emotional arousal. Most of the pictures that flash up in a random sequence are neutral pictures, pictures of nice scenery, friendly-looking people, and so on. But some of them are extremely shocking. Either they're hardcore pornography or they're scenes of extreme violence. They're emotionally disturbing pictures. When the emotionally disturbing pictures come on the screen, people's skin resistance changes, their pulse rate changes, as you'd expect. But the fascinating thing is that these changes occur 3 or 4 seconds before the pictures appear on the screen. People somehow pick up in advance. Their whole physiology reacts in advance of these shocking images appearing. And they couldn't know by any normal means, because the order in which the pictures appear is determined by the computer at random. Nobody knows. The experimenter doesn't know. This is all happening just inside the computer. So I think his experiments show that there's a presentiment in human beings, that a kind of precognition of the future influencing the present, which no one has been able to explain.
Well, the suggestion in the book is that time, linear time, the moment, what we consider now, is thicker than we believe it to be.
Yes, that's what I'm suggesting. That you see, one way of dealing with this kind of presentiment that Dean Radin has found is to say, well, our normal idea of the present is much too limited. Of course, the present as we experience it subjectively already has a certain thickness. We're not seeing things microsecond by microsecond. We blur together experience over many milliseconds into the present. That's why when we look at cine films, although there's a series of still images, 24 a minute, appearing a second, changes of image, image blank, image blank, we blend them together into a continuous moving image, because our minds actually have a thicker present than is objectively there on the actual screen. So I think there's a thicker present. Whether this accounts for premonitions of earthquakes by animals, which can happen hours or even days in advance, is another question, though. That there may be physical signs there, electrical changes and other physical stimuli, but nobody knows to what extent that kind of premonition can be explained in terms of physical stimuli or presentiment or precognition, something to do with the thickness of time.
Mm-hmm. So the whole notion of time as we know it is certainly being reconsidered, as Einstein suggested we ought to do anyway.
I think that premonitions and precognitions force us to look at our understanding of the nature of time. And personally, I'd prefer not to have to do this. I mean, morphic fields, telepathy, memory and nature, these are familiar topics for me. I feel comfortable with all those. Premonitions are much more disturbing, even to the kind of expanded worldview that I work on. And I've gone to considerable lengths to try and see if there are alternative explanations for this animal behavior, these premonitions. In some cases, there are, but in other cases, there aren't. And I think there has to be something like precognition or presentiment in humans and in animals.
Mm-hmm. Well, you studied philosophy at Harvard, and so I'd like to end with a bit of philosophy. We had an animal communicator in here on the program, and she believes that this subject of animal communication, telepathy, whatever you want to call it, she believes it's coming out at this time because our species is in desperate need to reconnect with nature, to live in the moment, as thick as it may be, and to learn about unconditional love. What do you think about those notions?
Well, I certainly think we need to learn to reconnect with nature and learn to rediscover that animals and the rest of the world are not just separate from us. They are to be manipulated by us for human profit and gain. And I think that our worldview needs to move beyond the mechanistic worldview to a more holistic worldview. Exactly why these are things are happening now, I don't know. I mean, there are many reasons, I think, that are forcing us towards a more holistic and interconnected view of the world. I think we need it just to understand the facts of science. I think biology particularly has had a kind of tunnel vision, which has been very destructive for the science and for the environment. So I think we need it for scientific reasons. I think we also need it for ecological reasons. The effects of our behavior are causing a major global crisis. In the realm of healthcare, we need it because the tunnel vision of institutional medicine obviously leaves a lot of things out, which is why there's this flourishing of alternative medicine. And as Andy Weil makes a very strong case for it, what we really need is integrative medicine that brings all these things together in a bigger picture. There's many areas of our lives in which we need this more holistic picture. And I think that pets, the animals we know best, can help us towards it because in a way, we already know that they know things that we can't explain. And when we recognize that they have these powers, we see daily demonstrations of this interconnectedness in our own homes.
It's just amazing. I mean, someone could look at that book and look at it for years and years and continue to get things out of it, continue to do some of the experiments that you suggest they do, keep a dog log and what have you. I'm very impressed with your work. It's been an honor to have you on the show, and I wish you continued success and happiness.
Thank you. And if anyone would like to get in touch with me, then could I just say again that they can do so through my website. It's www.sheldrake.org.
Yes, indeed. Our guest has been Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. The new book is Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home and Other Unexplained Powers of Animals.